Blog Talk Radio.
Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.
Good evening tonight. This is Ken Bullman, one of the co-hosts of Nature's News, welcoming you to our new show. Unfortunately, my co-host, Ken McKeegan, couldn't be here tonight, so I'm doing this one solo. This is my first one. And tonight, we have a really interesting guest on. I'll just give a little bit of background on him. Of course, I'm talking about Rhett Talbot. He's an award-winning freelance writer and photographer, and he does a lot of work with fisheries and sustainability. Some of his articles have appeared in publications such as Discover Magazine, Munga Bay, The Fish Site, Coral Magazine, Ocean Geographic, and others. Now, he lives in Maine with his wife, Karen, who's a scientific illustrator best known for her work with fishes as well. And he has written a book on Bengay cardinal fish, which we will talk about later. So I'd like to welcome you to the show, Mr. Rhett Talbot.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, as we've been advertising, this show is all about the Bengay cardinal fish. Can you start off by maybe telling us where in the world are they from?
The Bengay cardinal fish is a really interesting reef fish, and I say that for a lot of reasons. It's very striking looking, but specifically in terms of where it comes from, it's actually one of the reef fishes with the smallest known native range. The entire range of this fish is very small, about the size of Los Angeles Harbor, the available habitat in its range. And that habitat's located in the Bengay Islands in Indonesia. And it's north of Bali, which people may be familiar with, off the island of Sulawesi. And it's a beautiful, pretty remote part of the world, and it is the only place in the world where this fish is known to exist naturally.
Wow. What can you tell us about the sort of habitat they inhabit there?
The part of the Bengay cardinal fish's problem, if we want to call it a problem, and I think it is a problem, it's recently been listed under the Endangered Species Act because there are concerns about its conservation status. One of the interesting things about the fish is that it's very dependent on habitat. And so in most cases, people are familiar with the Bengay cardinal fish living in close association with spiny sea urchins. And in fact, if you know what the Bengay cardinal fish looks like with its silver to bronze body with those black vertical bars, many people believe that the black barring actually helps them to camouflage, especially when they're young, in the spines of black spiny sea urchins. But they also will live in close association with other animals as well, such as different coral species. They will not be found ever in open terrain. So what you find throughout their range in the Bengay Islands is you find them concentrated in these islands, either these large urchin mounds or in individual corals or sometimes anemones. And they'll be surrounded perhaps with open sand beds, shallow water, and they will not cross those open sand beds. And so that's one of the reasons this fish doesn't move very far. In many cases, they think that the young pretty much live their entire life fairly close to where they were originally settled.
Wow, that's quite different, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. I live in a small town in southwestern Ontario. We've only got two fish stores here, and from time to time I see them in the pet stores here even. How common are they in North America as far as in aquarium stores, the availability of them?
The Bengay cardinal fish was almost an overnight success in the aquarium trade. It was first introduced to aquarists in North America in 1996 at the Marine Aquarium Conference of North America, which I think was in Louisville, Kentucky that year. And by the late 90s, it's very hard to know the exact data, and that's a challenge we'll discuss throughout the evening tonight, I think, how challenging it is to actually know the data. But it's believed that maybe as many as 1 million fish were being harvested by the late 90s. They became very popular in the United States, and by the time we got to certainly 2005, which was really the peak of the aquarium, the marine aquarium trade in North America before the economic downturn, they were consistently one of the most imported animals. And if we look at imports over the course of the economic downturn from 2005 through 2008 to 9 to 11, the Bangai cardinal fish actually increases in rank, and I believe it was at its highest, it was the seventh most commonly imported fish to the United States. So very, very, very popular fish.
Wow, that must have been devastating to the local population, be it that they came from such a small locale.
And I think that's the challenge. I don't think that anyone, the marine aquarium trade really had not seen a species like that before. The vast majority, if we look at the top 10 or 14 fishes that are imported for the marine aquarium trade, that list remains fairly stable. And the vast majority of those fishes are highly fecund. They have huge ranges. It would be virtually, I don't want to say that it's impossible, but it would be very difficult to overfish any of those other species for the aquarium trade because the demand is so small relative to their populations, relative to their ability to reproduce, relative to their, extensive ranges. The Bangai cardinal fish, though, you're exactly right. The Bangai cardinal fish, only at that point only came from that very tiny area in the Bangai Islands, and it was essentially an area that had no fishing regulation whatsoever. And so the fishing had a very, detrimental effect on the population of the species. Really beginning in the late 1990s is when people began to raise some concerns.
Right. Who was it that actually started realizing that there could be a problem there? Was it like the Indonesian government themselves, or aquarists in North America, or scientists around the world? Who drew attention to the problem?
There is a scientist named Alejandro Vigeli. And he is certainly the preeminent expert in the world from the scientific community on the Bangai cardinal fish. And he had been doing a significant amount of work in the Bangai Islands, and he became very concerned early on that he saw that so many fish were being harvested. Began collecting data. The data was very limited early on, but as he became more concerned and as other people became more concerned, they set out to collect more and more data. And those data have really shown a pretty precipitous declines in most of the areas where these fish are. Now, unlike other fish, so if we wanted to take a look at blue chromis, for example, the blue-green damselfish, which is the consistently the number one most imported marine aquarium fish in the United States. If we wanted to go to an area and try to assess the population, we might literally see a school that's nearly the size of the entire United States import for a year swim by on a reef. They're that fecund. There are just so many of them, and they move about. They move from reef to reef. They might move along the coastline. The Bangai cardinal fish, like I said earlier, a Bangai cardinal fish may settle on an urchin mound, and for its entire life, it may not leave that urchin mound. It may not leave that one particular harbor. So what the jelly, I think, began to become very concerned about, and then others who were working there, Lini is an Indonesian NGO that has done a lot of work in the Bangai Islands, and they were looking at the data as well. And they became very concerned that you'd go back to these places where there were large populations of Bangai cardinal fish a year, 2 years, 3 years before, and now the population was tiny, if not gone altogether. And once they began to document these localized, these localized extinctions in a particular bay, for example, people really began to become concerned.
Yeah, and it's quite understandable that they would. I guess it would be very hard to increase the population on such solitary creatures. Now, how are they listed? Are they, like, endangered?
So what happens here is, you know, when most people think about the Bangai cardinal fish, they think about really a 20-year history. It's, you know, 2016 mm-hmm. now. The species was quote unquote rediscovered by Dr. Jerry Allen in 1996, or actually 1995, but he presented the fish in a scientific paper and then in an aquarium trade publication in 1996. So the aquarium industry has really only known about this fish for about 20 years. It was actually, and we can talk about this later if you're interested, it was actually specimens were collected in 1920, and those specimens were brought back to Europe and lost, essentially, for a number of years, and they weren't described for some 13 years later in the scientific literature. But when we get to the current history, that last 20 years, as we were talking about, you know, 1996, the species is introduced to the aquarium hobby by the late 1990s, very large harvest is occurring, almost no regulations, certainly not really any data. We didn't know how many species were being harvested. By the time we get to the early 2000s and then into 2004, Alejandro Vigeli in particular, along with some other scientists, began to express some real concerns and trying to encourage governments to get involved or fisheries managers to get involved. What happened then is in 2007, the United States, really with the leadership of Vigeli, they attempted to get the Bangai cardinal fish listed under CITES. And CITES, for those of you who don't know, is an international convention which regulates the trade in animals which may be threatened with extinction. And so in 2007, the United States proposed that this species, the Bangai cardinal fish, should be listed under CITES. A very interesting series of events occurred, and the end result of it was that the United States ended up withdrawing the proposal to list the species before there was even a vote. So the species was not listed in 2007. A couple months later in 2007, the IUCN Red List came out with an endangered listing for the species. And following that, some people in the aquarium trade began to become involved on a grassroots level, and then they got some support from the Marine Aquarium Societies of North America, MASNA. They also got some support from the trade media, and there was really a grassroots effort in 2008 to get concerned aquarists to boycott wild-caught Bangai cardinal fish. And as we discussed a minute ago, even as that was going on, even as there was highly publicized talk about the challenges this species was facing in its endemic and its native range, the imports to the United States of the species continued to go up and up and up. And so while the aquarium trade in the United States, the marine aquarium trade in the United States, had about a 25% contraction from 2005 to 2011, as a direct result or primarily as a result of the economic downturn, the Bangai cardinal fish only suffered about a 10% decline. So relative to other species, we were actually importing more Bangai cardinal fish despite the fact that people were saying we need to stop importing this fish. So that brings us to the current conversation about the ESA, and that was in 2013. An organization and a non-governmental organization, Wild Earth Guardians, petitioned the National Marine Fisheries Service which in this country is responsible for marine fishes. They petitioned the National Marine Fisheries Service to list the Bangai cardinal fish under the Endangered Species Act. And that set in motion a whole chain of events that was just resolved last month in January with the listing of the species as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. So a long answer to your question, where we are today, January 2016, the Bangai cardinal fish was listed as threatened under the endangered species list and became the first marine aquarium fish to be listed under the ESA.
Wow, that's quite a history of possible conservation efforts. Now, is this, in your opinion, is this something that should have been done some time ago, or is it timely?
Well, as somebody who reports on fisheries, I try to focus on the data and not get too involved with my opinion. I will say that I traveled to the Bangai Islands as an embedded journalist with a scientific expedition in 2012. The scientific expedition was going to specifically look at the Bangai cardinal fish, and even more specifically, to look at a virus which was affecting the Bangai cardinal fish to see if they could identify whether the virus was coming from the wild or not. And I will say that all of the scientists who were engaged in that expedition all left feeling very strongly that we should be very concerned about the Bangai cardinal fish. And until better fisheries management was in place, until better conservation measures were in place, that probably the best thing to do was to only purchase aquaculture Bangai cardinal fish. Certainly as somebody who, you know, lived with these scientists for several weeks in pretty remote conditions, we all had a lot of conversations, and I think we all walked away with a similar impression. For me, though, the last part of your question was, you know, do I think it's timely or should it have happened earlier? I'm surprised, and I won't necessarily come out strongly with my own opinion of what was going on in 2007 and 2008, but I'm very surprised that the aquarium trade did not respond more proactively in 2007 and 2008. And I think the marine aquarium trade really lost an opportunity there. And I think the consequence has been that this is certainly the way it's been referred to in social media and some other pundits who talk about the aquarium trade. They'll talk about it as this is a black eye in the marine aquarium trade. And it certainly is. I mean, it's really a shame that we know that these large numbers of this species that's particularly vulnerable because of its life history and because of its endemic range, that we just couldn't curtail, we couldn't engage and curtail the demand for the species.
Well, it certainly is an attractive species, as you mentioned earlier, and you can understand why everyone wants it, I guess. Now, I guess the next important question is, if we're not taking from the wild, we must breed them. How easy are they to actually breed home situation or whatever?
Yeah, no, we started off this conversation talking about how interesting and unique this species is. And when it was first introduced to the aquarium trade in 1996, it was introduced as the poster fish for the aquarium trade. It was easy to keep, it stayed relatively small, and it was simple to breed. That was one of its selling points. The Bangai cardinal fish is a mouth brooder, and so the males actually carry the young in their mouth and then release them when they're reached a developmental stage where they can fend for themselves. So it's a relatively easy fish to breed in captivity, and early on there was lots of talk about people doing this. Now, in order to tell the next chapter of the story, we have to mention something that I mentioned in passing, and that is this virus. Sometime around the early 2000s, maybe late 90s, we began to see anecdotal reports in aquarium forums, at aquarium clubs, a couple scientists here and there who began reporting mass mortalities of Bengai cardinal fish that they had imported from the wild for the purposes of breeding. We had several very capable, very capable major aquaculture facilities that deal with marine ornamental fishes who imported them to breed and couldn't keep them alive. And here was this fish that was supposed to be incredibly easy to keep alive, incredibly easy to breed in captivity, and people were just not having success doing it. And so this virus, we think, was having a significant impact, although it's very difficult to do the forensics and figure out exactly where the virus was coming from and what the effect was. But it was it proposed some real challenges, and a lot of people attribute the failure for commercial aquaculture early on to this virus. It's an arytovirus. The same virus, for those of you who are familiar, more familiar with freshwater, this is the same virus that that hit the freshwater industry in Florida in the 1990s, the early 1990s, and really almost wiped out the aquaculture, the freshwater aquaculture industry in Florida. So a very dangerous, very, very lethal virus. Fast forward to today, and again, this is what makes this story so interesting. In July of 2013, when Wild Earth Guardians petitioned National Marine Fisheries Service to list the species, something else was going on, and that was that there was a aquaculture facility not in the United States, overseas in Southeast Asia, that began in 2012 and then really ramping up in 2013 to produce, for the first time, large-scale commercial aquaculture of the species. So by the time we get to 2013, if we go back and look at the United States import data now, we can see that this single aquaculture facility in Thailand that managed to figure out how to do this species on a commercial scale, to breed it on a commercial scale, they were providing as much as 75% of the entire demand for the species through aquacultured fishes. So just an overnight radical change to the fishery.
Wow, that's amazing. Just as a by the by question, was the virus affecting any other fishes in the region that you know of?
And that's one thing that these the scientists who I traveled to Indonesia with, that's one thing they were looking at. We know that the Bengai cardinal fish, or we observed that the Bengai cardinal fish, and we also heard reports, Vigeli detailed this as well as other people who have spent time in the fishery, they are held in net pens in the bays oftentimes before they are then collected, packaged, and shipped to begin their journey to market. And so they're oftentimes held closely with blue tang, the pallid surgeon fish. And so mm-hmm. there was some speculation that perhaps other species may be hosting the virus, but they don't become symptomatic, and then they pass it on to the Bengai cardinal fish in these overcrowded conditions, in these net pens. That was one possibility. There's also the possibility that by the time the Bengai cardinal fish are shipped to the exporters, oftentimes in Denpasar and Bali, and then on to the importers in the market countries, they are obviously mixed with a lot of other fishes then as well. And so that's an avenue they've really tried to explore. We know that this virus has the ability to jump species, which is one of the things that makes it so scary. And so that certainly is a possibility. I don't think that we have the concrete forensic evidence yet to say with confidence that's what was happening, but it's certainly a distinct possibility.
Wow. Is there any certification that accompanies a fish that is brought in an bred in an aquacultural facility, or you just don't know that it's a wild fish or one that has been aquacultured?
That certainly is a very real problem, and it's certainly a question that that aquaculture companies, or challenged aquaculture companies, have to face. I know, for example, that there are certainly allegations and actually some data to back up those allegations. Back when Ocean Reefs and Aquariums, ORA in Florida, when they first had the breakthrough with the mandarin and they brought the mandarin fish to market as an aquacultured specimen, which seemed to be great news because here was a species that really did fairly poorly for most aquarists when caught from the wild, and there's a lot of reasons why it did poorly. But these aquacultured ones were really sort of bomb-proof. They were bulletproof fish that they ate a captive diet. They didn't have the same sort of problems. We know that there were certainly wild-caught mandarin fish that were coming into the country, and then some of them were being passed off as aquacultured fishes. This certainly happens. And one of the reasons this happens is because we have a major price issue in the marine aquarium trade. The marine aquarium trade, if you look at those top 10 most imported species to the United States, the average price of those top 10 fish is less than $15. Half of them are less than $7 as a wild-caught fish, with many of them costing only a couple of dollars if you buy them with a volume discount. So with animals that are valued that little, it's very difficult for an aquaculture facility to come along and actually make a profit or even get their money back on trying to sell an aquaculture fish, which is generally substantially more expensive. So there's been all sorts of concerns about, the Bangai cardinal fish, and I know that was an impediment to some breeders getting more involved with commercially breeding Bangai cardinal fish. It was too costly, and the price of wild-caught fish was too low. If we go back to that 2012-2013 period when we began to see aquacultured Bangai cardinal fish coming in, we do feel really good that we know those fish were aquacultured. And the reason we know that is because they were all coming into the United States from one facility. So we can go back and, people have gone back. Not everybody can just go look at the information. But you can request the data from the government. You can get the data. You can go through the data. And the data clearly show that that these animals, these Bangai cardinal fish, were coming from a country where they don't exist in the wild. So we have that chain of custody. We also know that they were all going to one importer in Los Angeles, and we know that one importer in Los Angeles is really known for having some of the most protected and best supply chains in terms of knowing where their fish are originating. And we also know that that the fish went from there to retailers across the United States, but we know that a number of them went to one of our largest, and continue to go to one of our largest big box pet stores, which is Petco. I don't know. In the United States, certainly, we're very Live Aquaria, Foster's and Smith is considered to be sort of the online, premier source for marine aquarium fishes. Live Aquaria does a very good job. They recently have merged with Petco a couple years ago, and so a lot of those Bangai cardinal fish were now going into Live Aquaria, and Live Aquaria was able to. They took a really bold step, and I think it was potentially a risky step for them, but it really changed, it shifted the whole dynamic of the Bangai cardinal fish trade. They eliminated wild-caught Bangai cardinal fish, and they were able to drop the price on their aquaculture Bangai cardinal fish down to the same price and then even lower than what the wild fish were costing. And, almost overnight, that really changed the dynamic in the United States with this species. So that was pretty exciting, and it can happen. But as I explained, that's a very specific case because it's going from one aquaculture facility through a chain of custody that's documented by Fish and Wildlife Service into the Port of Los Angeles to only one wholesaler and then out predominantly to a couple of retail stores. So we feel really good about those fish. We don't feel so good about sometimes we have more questions about other species, whether they are actually aquacultured.
Right. So you would be comfortable in saying that it's quite likely that the majority of the Bengay cardinal fish in northern Melbourne, certainly in the States, would come from a cultured source.
Yeah, it seems that way right now. It seems that we haven't seen the most recent trade data that we have is unfortunately only 2011. So we do actually have some trade data on Bengay cardinal fish as recent as 2013, but it's difficult to get this data. It's difficult to verify those data, and it's difficult to sort of, you know, crunch them and then be able to tell people, you know, what's actually going on. But yes, I think aquarists in the United States should feel very confident, certainly when you're buying from a reputable dealer like Vive Aquaria, that these fish are coming from, you know, if they say they're aquaculture. Also, they tend to be pretty small. These fish have been coming in smaller. The larger fish that we've seen tend to still be wild-caught fish more often than not, and that may change as the aquaculture facility and other aquaculture facilities have now begun to get involved as well. And, you know, they may be able to provide a much broader range of size offerings in the future. But I think with Bengay cardinal fish, we can feel pretty confident.
Well, that's great news. Is it like a game of dominoes? Has successfully breeding these in an aquaculture facility led to maybe some other species being bred through the research that they did to breed the Bengays? Like, did that help breed other species that you know of?
The facility that bred the Bengay cardinal fish, my understanding is, and there's a lot of secrecy around it because it's proprietary and there's a lot of money tied up in it potentially. My understanding is that they have come at this from the food fish aquaculture world. And so they've probably applied some technologies that might be a little bit outside of the box in terms of ornamental aquaculture. So they have, to the best of my knowledge, they have not been forthright with their procedures and their protocols. So I don't think the aquaculture industry has necessarily learned a lot from them about this species. But I do think that we are at a period right now when it comes to marine ornamental aquaculture. We're at a very exciting period. You know, we just had the yellow tang. The Oceanic Institute in Hawaii has been working with this species for years and you know, for a decade, and they are having some really dramatic, significant successes with that species. And to me, you know, that's exciting. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending upon how you choose to look at it, the yellow tang is one of the very few marine aquarium fish that arrives to market as a wild-caught fish from a demonstrably sustainable fishery. We know that Hawaii aquarium fishery is sustainable because we have a preponderance of data and fisheries managers are regulating that fishery. So, you know, do we need aquaculture yellow tang like we need aquaculture Bengay cardinal fish? Not so much, but I'm really excited because now the folks down at the University of Florida's Tropical Aquaculture Lab, really forward-thinking, hard-working aquaculturists who have had a lot of success with a variety of species. They have been working on the blue tang down there, and they've been working in close collaboration with the Oceanic Institute with some umbrella funding from Rising Tide. And what we're seeing is maybe some synergy that's going to help them have a breakthrough with a blue tang, you know, potentially sooner rather than later, was what Kevin Barden, the fellow who's doing most of the work down there, that's what he told me in an interview back in December, that, you know, he expects we're going to see aquaculture blue tang sooner rather than later. So even though we may not have learned, we may not be learning a lot from the facility that was dealing with the Bengay cardinal fish in Southeast Asia, we certainly are having dramatic success and progress with the aquaculture of marine ornamental fishes. I think the big question in my mind is, will aquarists be willing to pay the price that these fishes cost when compared with relatively inexpensive you know, wild caught fish.
Wild caught,
and
that, yeah.
That's the big unknown. Yeah, that's the big unknown. And that's a huge issue. And this is probably a topic for another night. But that's a huge issue with the sequel, The Finding Nemo, coming out this spring or this summer.
Yes.
You know, we think we saw, you know, that the data suggests that we saw at least a 30% rise in clownfish sales following Finding Nemo. And here we have a clownfish which is easily bred in captivity, relatively easy to keep, stays relatively small. In other words, you know, Sally can walk into Petco with her dad and say, "Dad, I want a Nemo," and he can buy a nano tank and a Nemo fish and go home, and everything will probably be okay. You can't do that with a blue tang. They have yet to be bred in captivity. We have very serious concerns about localized overfishing in some of the aquarium fisheries where they're commonly harvested. It's a species that gets much too large for the average aquarist's tank, and it's a species that isn't terribly easy to keep and is known to be susceptible to parasites and stress, et cetera. So we've got our work cut out for us there.
I guess it was a popular fish because, as you say, it's a little bit harder to keep. So people were actually killing it before it achieved its maximum growth. So they didn't realize that fish that they killed was only a youngster.
Mm-hmm.
I guess.
Yeah.
And that's a problem with a lot of fish. I know, even goldfish. People don't realize how big a goldfish will grow if given the proper conditions and everything.
No, you're exactly right, and that's I've done quite a bit of work. Again, a topic for another night, but I've done quite a bit of work in the past, and I'm working on a big story now regarding the connection between bringing in, importing, and then novice aquarists buying fishes that grow far too large for their aquarium. And what we think is happening is that those are the fishes that are being released into the wild, and they've caused some serious invasive species issues, and we've got some serious invasive species issues that are on the horizon if we don't get a hold of, you know, importing these species that really don't have the business being in anyone's tank. You know, nobody needs an 800-pound grouper for their home aquarium.
That's right.
Some of these animals come in as a couple inches large and they're cute, and they don't cost very much, and people buy them, and then all of a sudden they get big, and they, you know, it seems like the humane thing to do, and unfortunately I'm afraid that Pixar and Disney is reinforcing that with their current iteration of Finding Dory. You know, people think the compassionate thing to do is to release them into the wild. And of course that might be the compassionate thing maybe for that individual fish, but for every other fish that has the potential to be wiped out by an invasive species that they have no defense against, no familiarity with, it's an ecological disaster.
Actually, we have a show specifically for invasive species and conservation efforts. Maybe we could arrange for you to come on at some later date and we'll talk about that problem.
Well, that's a topic near and dear to my heart. I would be honored.
Excellent. Thank you for that. Now, with the Endangered Species Act, we know that it's got Bengo cardinal fish, and you said that was the first fish that's been, the first marine fish that's been put on it. Should there be more on it?
That's a great question. And, you know, I think at this point, when we look at, so the Bengo cardinal fish was listed in January as threatened. It became the first marine aquarium fish to go on the list. If we look at the other top 10 or top 14 fishes that get imported to the United States, there's really no other species on that list that's similar to the Bengo cardinal fish in terms of limited range and you know, not having that high fecundity that we're used to with most reef fishes. So I really think it's relatively unlikely that the National Marine Fisheries Service, knowing what we know today, would list another marine fish under the Endangered Species Act. They've actually looked at several in the past year. The one that got the most attention was the Furcula clownfish, the orange clownfish, was petitioned for listing under the Endangered Species Act. And National Marine Fisheries Service determined after a very thorough year-long status review that no, the species was not, in fact, at risk of extinction because the population, the global population is just so huge. And even though the aquarium trade seems relatively large, and we talk about, 7.4 million fishes coming into the United States each year, marine aquarium fishes coming to the United States each year, that's a relatively small number when we're talking about species who, have hundreds of thousands estimated populations throughout their range. So the short answer to the question is I don't expect that we will see another marine aquarium fish listed in the near term. I think we'll certainly see some petitioned. And so for those of your listeners that aren't familiar with the way the ESA works, any citizen or citizen group or NGO can petition the National Marine Fisheries Service that there is a marine species that should be listed under the ESA. And they have to present a petition, and that petition has to contain scientific information and trade data that shows the National Marine Fisheries Service reviewers that, yes, in fact, we need to take a closer look. So once a petition is filed, National Marine Fisheries Service takes 90 days. They're supposed to take 90 days. Sometimes it goes much longer. But they're supposed to take 90 days. Look at that species, and then come back with what's called a 90-day finding. And that 90-day finding determines whether or not they're going to engage in a full status review. If they decide they're going to move forward with a full status review, as they did with the Bangai cardinal fish and as they did with the Furcula clownfish, the orange clownfish, they will then take a year, generally, from the date of the petition being submitted, and oftentimes it goes much longer than a year, but they'll take a year to do a full status review. They'll review all the scientific literature. They'll interview experts. They really, dig as deep as they can into the best available information and the best available data. And then they come back with what's called a 12-month finding. And in that 12-month finding, they either say, yep, this animal is warranted for listing, or no, this animal isn't warranted for listing. If it is warranted for listing, then they go ahead and they publish what's called a proposed rule. And the proposed rule, which this is what happened not December 2015, but December 2014 with the Bangai cardinal fish, they publish a proposed rule, say, we think this species should be listed, and then there's a year where there's more sort of public comment, more discussion, more data is gathered, and then they publish their final rule, and that's what happened in January. So I do think we're going to see more species petitioned. I would not be surprised to see the blue tang petitioned. I don't think, however, that the blue tang would make it through to an actual listing because I think that even though there is localized overfishing that we're very concerned about in some places, I don't think range-wide we're looking at the species actually going extinct.
Well, that process is almost as bad as trying to get a fish into Australia. As an Australian, I know what that's all about.
Yes, I've heard the horror stories. I think it's important to point that out to your listeners too, though, that the endangered species listing process is a very thorough and very scientific database procedure that they go through, where there's plenty of opportunity for public comment and for feedback and a back and forth and a back and forth. And so I think when they determine that a species does in fact need to be listed under the Endangered Species Act, it's not just, there's a lot of people sort of say off the cuff on social media, a bunch of scientists sitting in an office building in Maryland made that decision. When in reality, I've had the opportunity to get to know some of these people who work for National Marine Fisheries Service in a professional context through interviewing them, and the work they do is just incredible, and they do a phenomenal service. And so I think we dismiss their findings to our own detriment.
Well, as you say, it's up to the individual aquarist, all our listeners, get involved. in the process, educate yourself on what is happening, and you can have some input, and it might sway something. Actually, I've got a couple of questions from the chat room for you, Rhett.
Sure.
Which is worse, a threatened fish or an endangered fish?
Well, for the fish, endangered, endangered is the worst case scenario for the species. So there's so much, you know, once you get digging into this, there's so many nuances that people don't necessarily and have no reason to really understand or know. But there's a very key distinction that I just want to take a minute to familiarize your listeners Sure. with, because it's often misunderstood. There are two government agencies in the United States that deal with the Endangered Species Act, that are responsible for implementing it. It's the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, and they deal with most freshwater fishes and most terrestrial animals. And then we have the National Marine Fisheries Service under NOAA, and the National Marine Fisheries Service deals with most marine species. Now, because of things that would take far too long to explain here, they actually approach the way they list a species differently. The United States Fish and Wildlife Service, if a species is listed as either threatened, which is the lower risk level, or endangered, which is the higher risk level, that species automatically trade stops. Automatically, you cannot take that species. You cannot harass it. You cannot harm it. You cannot capture it. You cannot keep it. You cannot trade it. These are all activities that are contained under Section 9 of the ESA. And so the United States Fish and Wildlife Service automatically applies all of these Section 9 prohibitions right out of the gate if any species is listed as either threatened or endangered. National Marine Fisheries Service does it a little bit differently. If a species is listed as endangered, and the Bengal cardinal fish was not, if it's listed as endangered, the National Marine Fisheries Service then applies the Section 9 prohibition. If you can't keep it, you can't take it, you can't harm it, you can't harass it, you can't do anything with it. If it's listed as threatened, nothing changes in terms of those what are called take prohibitions. So even though the Bengal cardinal fish was listed as threatened in the Endangered Species Act, it's still perfectly legal to trade the species, to sell the species, to collect the species. None of that's changed. National Marine Fisheries Service, in order to apply those prohibitions, they will have to go through what's called a rulemaking process. It's called a 4D rulemaking process. And they will determine through that process whether or not they think that some of those prohibitions are necessary. So right now, nothing changes based on the listing as threatened. Mm-hmm. We can move through the 4D rulemaking process, which can happen really at any time. But again, it's a public process. There'll be public announcement about it. There'll be an opportunity for public comment. And they could determine at the end of that 4D process that, nope, we're going to say nobody can keep them, nobody can trade them, they're just done. Or they could decide we're going to allow the trade in aquaculture Bengal cardinal fish, but we're not going to allow the trade in wild-caught Bengal cardinal fish. So they really have a very broad range of tools at their disposal that the United States Fish and Wildlife Service doesn't use to really try to tailor their response to a particular species. So so to answer the chatter's question, endangered is the more serious designation, threatened is the less serious, and under the National Marine Fisheries Service jurisdiction, a threatened listing means nothing immediately in terms of affecting trade or the ability to keep the species.
Thank you for that. Now, should our listeners get in the habit of asking if the fish they're buying from whatever source is aquacultured or caught from the wild? Would that help, do you think?
As a blanket advice, whenever I speak to aquarium groups, one of the pieces of advice I always try to leave people with is yes, you should be asking where your fish originated. And you should also understand that you often may not get a satisfactory response. There is not a lot of traceability in the marine aquarium trade right now, so we don't necessarily It's very difficult sometimes for the retail store, for the local fish store, the pet store, to know where that fish came. They might know what wholesaler they bought it from, but they might not necessarily know where that wholesaler sourced the animal from. You know, like we said, a lot of these species come from a very broad range, and so they might be bringing in blue tang from Philippines, from Indonesia, from Solomon Islands, and once they get to that wholesaler facility in Los Angeles, they might be being all mixed together. And so we really don't have a lot of traceability. There are a couple of companies which are doing some really good work trying to sort of change that dynamic, but we're not quite there yet. But ask the question. Asking the question, I think, is going to be central to really forcing some sort of trade reform or some sort of change in the way that the marine aquarium trade deals with traceability and deals with supply chains. And I should also add, and I do have a very strong opinion on this actually. And when it comes to wild caught fish, it's not as simple as saying aquacultured fish are always the sustainable choice and wild caught fish are always the unsustainable choice. The reality is that aquacultured fishes are almost always a good choice, especially for novice aquarists. And I say especially for novice aquarists because your aquacultured fish is generally going to be a hardier fish. It's going to be acclimated to a captive environment from the beginning. It's going to eat captive bred food because that's all eating from the beginning. So it's generally a better fish for the beginning aquarist, and the beginning aquarist may have more success with that aquacultured fish. But there are sustainable aquarium fisheries throughout the Indo-Pacific, particularly from some of the smaller developing island nations, places like Solomon Islands, places like Fiji. These are places where the marine aquarium trade is actually one of the most positive economic forces for reef conservation. And so supporting those sustainable aquarium fisheries is good for not only the reef and the species, but it's also really good for the local fishers and fisher communities who really benefit from the aquarium trade, which tends to be a high-value, low-biomass fishery, as opposed to food fisheries, which tend to be low-value, high-biomass, and so much more prone to overfishing than say, an aquarium fishery. So it really is, it's very nuanced, and I would encourage your listeners to just familiarize themselves as much as they can with the process, and ask, where do your fish come from? And be prepared that, you know, the person asking may not have a good response, but if enough people ask, hopefully the question will make its way back up the food chain, and, you know, eventually we'll have a more traceable trade.
Excellent. Now, we can't have this show without mentioning one other thing, at least, and I alluded to it earlier. You were one of the co-writers of a book on Bengay cardinal fish, weren't you?
I was, yeah. Yeah, it was that book actually originated, my part of the book originated from that scientific expedition I talked about earlier tonight. The book was a phenomenal project. It was really the brainchild of James Lawrence, who's the publisher and editor-in-chief over a Coral magazine and Amazonas magazine. Two magazines, by the way, that really do a phenomenal job in reporting on source side of the industry, really reporting on where the fish are originating and how they're being harvested and making their way to market. James came up with this idea, and he initially bounced the idea off me and said, what do you think? And, you know, I think both of us felt like this was a species that seemed to need some attention because we had a bunch of people saying this species is going extinct, and we had a bunch of people saying there's nothing wrong with the species at all, and we didn't even touch on tonight the issue with the introduced populations of this species, which oftentimes is a big part of the debate about whether or not the species is really in trouble or not. But we just heard all this conflicting information, and so the decision was made that let's go and get the story, and that turned into a book, and we launched the book through a Kickstarter campaign, which was incredibly exciting to see the enthusiasm around supporting this project. And I think we were able to help a couple of really top-notch scientists get into the field, do some important work. Matt Peterson was involved with this project as well, and he did some really solid work, not only on the history, but also himself working in his fish room, breeding Bengai cardinal fish and trying to understand protocols and procedures and also what was going on with the virus. So it was a real collaborative effort, and it was very exciting. And the last thing I'll say about the book, which if anyone is able to pick it up and read it, there's an introduction by Dr. Jerry Allen. And to me, or I guess it's actually the foreword, is by Dr. Jerry Allen. And to me, that's really the take-home point of this book. Jerry Allen is the individual who first rediscovered the Bengai cardinal fish in the mid-90s. And he was the one who introduced the Bengai cardinal fish to the aquarium trade in 1996, having no idea what that action was going to, what chain of events that action was going to set off. And so the fact that he was able to sort of circle back and write the foreword to this book that was really seeking to educate people about, you know, the true story behind the Bengai cardinal fish was really, you know, it was exciting, I think, for him to have an opportunity to say, you know, wow, I had no idea what was going to happen. And for him to also, you know, share his opinions about how important it is that we address these issues, you know, thoughtfully, and we move forward, you know, not only with our own hobby in mind, but more importantly, with the species in mind.
It's great that you could get Dr. Jerry to do that. I know him through my work in North America with ANCFA. He's one of the patrons of ANCFA, the Australian New Guinea Fishers Association, from Australia.
Yeah.
And,
absolutely, yeah.
Very well known in ichthyological circles. Now,
absolutely.
Of course,
and
if anyone wants... Sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, if any of our readers would like to get a copy of the book, you can, of course, go to Coral Magazine or Amazonas Magazine, click on the shop button. You can either get it as an e-book or a soft cover book. I guess you could always go to Amazon as well, get it from there, check the prices, see whichever one's best for you.
And if you, my wife sells the book too through her gallery, because she actually did, she was a scientific illustrator on the book, so she did a number of scientific illustrations. So if you buy it through her gallery online, you can also actually get some of the artwork that was included in the book as well, and she'll sign it.
There you go.
We'll both sign it.
Well, we may as well. What's the website there, Rhett? Please.
Her website is www.karentalbotartonline.com. So karentalbotartonline.com.
Excellent. And I guess if any of our listeners want to buy the book from her website, you might even
sign it
for them too.
We're a little more expensive than Amazon, unfortunately, but we will sign it for you.
Well, there you go. There's your opportunity to get a signed book directly from one of the authors and the illustrator.
Exactly.
Right. Well, that brings us to the top of the hour, and time has flown. Now,
oh, this has been really fun. Thank you.
It's been great, and we obviously would like to have you back at some future date. Maybe we'll talk about the problems with invasive species or something.
Well, I would be honored, and I think you know, nothing is more important than the work that you guys do, and other shows and podcasts, and you know what we try to do as writers as well, just to try to encourage people to be having the conversation. We might not always agree at the end of the day, but I think if we're having the dialogue, we're all moving in the right direction, and that's very important. And the aquarium trade is at a very very important turning point right now, so we need to be having that dialogue.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Any last comment? Well, you've just given it, but actually, how easy is it to keep them? I guess the short answer is buy your book and find out.
Keeping Bengai cardinal fish is, if you get solid fish to begin with, it is relatively easy. And you will most likely, especially if you have a tank where they are happy, you will see them breed in your aquarium. It's not uncommon at all for average aquarists to have them breed, to be able to see the male's mouth groove. Their mouth gets huge. You can see little eyes inside their mouth. It's the most wonderful fascinating thing. You'll find the babies in your overflow stock, and you can rear them up, and it's a wonderful species. And I think, you know, hopefully if we move beyond the issues with the virus, if we move beyond the conservation concerns, we can get back to the point where the Bengai cardinal fish truly is a poster fish for the aquarium trade.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much.
I want to say thank you,
Ken,
Rhett. That
it.
Was great.
Thanks, Mary. I appreciate it.
It was awesome and such a fascinating topic. I bet we could go on forever and ask you more questions because it's very important that people know about this.
It is, and they're a wonderful fish, a wonderful species.
Fantastic.
Very good. Do you have any announcements, Mary?
Yeah, first off, I wanted to thank Rhett and you for taking the time out of your busy schedule. Rhett, I know that you are just a man of many things, so we wish you all the best. And I look forward to bringing you back on in the future. I can't wait to have you back on the show. It will be fun.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
And but okay, the biggest announcement I'm going to say tonight is we're so excited to say that we are going to bring Nature's Talk Show starting April live at conventions. We're going to launch our live show at the NEC convention in Connecticut, and it's going to be a blast. Come and see us if you would like to be interviewed by Ken or myself. Please hit us up, Ken. You can get a hold of Ken, myself, or Tom, and we will get you scheduled. If you would like to have us test your product, or if you have samples you would like to share with our listeners, please let us know. Like I say, contact me, Tom, or Ken at Nature's Talk Show, and we will be happy to help you. Also, you can follow us on Twitter, and you can hit us up on LinkedIn. One of the most important things is to follow us on Blog Talk. Go to www.blogtalkradio.com/Nature's Talk Show and click on that follow button. We are starting lots of new shows, new series, new things. Of course, my passion is invasive species. It's something that's very dear to me and something that we all as responsible aquarists or even hobbyists with plants and whatever else, something we need to be aware of. We cannot just do certain things. So we are going to start launching that again, and that will be a great show. So that's all that I have to say for this evening, and I want to thank all of our listeners around the world for tuning in tonight, for participating in the chat room and being a part of Nature's Talk Show, and we shall see you all Monday evening. Thank you, Ken. Thank you, Rhett. Have a great weekend, everyone, and be safe.
Good
thank you.
Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.